Friends, it's a pleasure to welcome you to session 172, Anti-Mormonism in the 2012 Presidential Campaign. Someone said we're up against Mother in Heaven, and that's a tough competition. Reminds me of the slogan I once saw, I think it was something out of Africa, it said, "If it came out of woman, man, you better believe it." And I guess that would apply to all of us, wouldn't it? My name is Bob Reese. I've been very interested in this subject for some time and very pleased to have two distinguished panelists to address the issue of anti-Mormonism in the 2012 presidential campaign. Patrick Mason is a professor and the Howard W. Hunter Professor of Mormon Studies at Graduate Theological, or excuse me, that's where I teach.
I was going to say, did I get your job all of a sudden?
At Claremont Graduate University in Southern California. And Patrick has a distinguished career in scholarly studies relating to Mormonism, and as someone who was responsible for having set up the Howard W. Hunter Chair and Program in Mormon Studies at Claremont, I've been delighted to see someone replace Richard Cushman in that position. And I was talking to Greg Prince not too long ago, and he said the problem with chairs in Mormon Studies is that generally you raise a lot of money and then you look for somebody who is distinguished and kind of at the end of their career, and then they come in and kind of sit there and occupy this chair, and I'm pleased to say that Richard didn't do that. I'm pleased to see that Richard's replacement is a young scholar who brings with him all of the virtues of being both a good scholar and a young scholar. Jennifer Dahmer is an award-winning journalist who has been associated with both the San Diego Union Tribune and also has been associated with writing about Mormonism for a number of years. For a number of years, she was the Associated Press person to write on Mormon issues from the center of Mormonism. And she was, the clerk received, was the last journalist to interview President Gordon B. Hinckley, who surprises me didn't say to her, and maybe he did, "Well, you still have a chance to hear the word from a prophet."
Oh, yeah, he totally did. He also wagged his finger at me and said if he wasn't happy, he was going to haunt me from the other side. And I have his picture hanging in my house when he's doing this, and I'm laughing, and I think my plumber gave me a discount because of it.
It's hard for me to imagine President Hinckley haunting anybody.
He's just a charmer.
Sweet gentleman. I'm supposed to do some house cleaning things, which is to tell you to turn off your cell phones and to behave yourselves while the session is going on. And when the time comes to use the microphone to ask questions. As long as humans have believed, there have been anti-religious sentiments. I had a brother who was baptized when we were young, left the church in his teen years, and became an avowed atheist, and who spent his whole life being an anti-Mormon to his Mormon brother, me. This is not something that's new. Anciently, the enmity between believers and non-believers and the conflict among believers themselves have helped to define the contours of history. Today, religious and anti-religious adherents seem no further advanced in their willingness to accept the right of other believers to occupy the same planet, let alone the same country as they do. As far as Christianity is concerned, persecution began the moment Jesus challenged the established religions of his time. And as soon as the new Christian religion began to splinter, the various factions began warring among themselves. Today, families, neighborhoods, tribes, groups, and entire nations are riven by this kind of religious and internecine conflict. That word, by the way, comes from the Latin Intermecare, we meaning to destroy or to kill, often by violent means. So when we see Jews and Arabs and Christians and Jews and Hindus and Muslims and other people all over the world expressing their enmity for others' beliefs in violent ways, it shouldn't surprise us that in modern times we would still have strong anti-Mormon sentiment, in at least in American culture, that as soon as Joseph Smith walked out of the Sacred Grove and announced to people, beginning really in quite a quiet and personal way within his own family, the vision that he had, which was the beginning of a number of visions, what he said attracted the enmity of other believers, and that enmity has continued to the present day. And while, as we look at the history of anti-religion in American culture, you see that it began as soon as the Puritans came over, and there was some divergence between different sects of those people, and they, some were banished from the Puritan communities. Then, when you had the beginning of Catholicism in the United States, anti-Catholic sentiment became very strong and violent, with the burning of churches and the tearing down of crosses from Catholic churches. Slowly, there was an accommodation to other religious beliefs to some extent. The Mormons, who then separated from the body politic as well as the body of the United States and went to this this great basin kingdom that continued. John Russell declared in 1853, "Our institutions, which guarantee the freedom of religious opinion to the Jews, the Mohammedans, the pagans, even to the atheists, have afforded no such protection to the Mormons." While anti-Mormonism, especially its more virulent forms, has abated as Mormons have moved into the mainstream of American society, and as the Church has made a concerted effort to gain respectability and to find a common cause with other religions, the present presidential campaign reveals that much of it has just been dormant, has lain just below the surface. In the blogosphere, on evangelical media outlets, even in the mainstream media, the old bête noire of the anti-Mormon forest have come back to life, often with renewed ferocity. Polygamy, multiple and strange gods, another Jesus, Satan is our brother, weird underwear, etc. All of these things have resurfaced during the presidential campaign. Fortunately, as opposed to previous eras, the church and church-related or affiliated groups and organizations and individual Mormons have taken a more assertive and proactive stance in relation to anti-Mormonism. In fact, if you Google anti-Mormonism, what you'll find is a number of Mormon responses on YouTube and elsewhere countering anti-Mormonism. So it's kind of anti-Mormonism, like the anti-Nephi Beehives, I suppose. Mormonism's place in American society, therefore, has gone through this very interesting transition. The old paradigm of Mormons being seen as foreign, un-American, exotic, gave way to some extent to Mormons being seen as respectable, industrious, patriotic, good folks. And yet this idea of Mormonism as being zealots, weird, and secretive, fanatics, extremists, sexually repressive, powerful, all of those images that one sees resurfacing in the current presidential campaign reminds us that anti-Mormonism remains one of the continued accepted prejudices in Mormon or in American culture. So someplace between Tolstoy's idea in the 19th century, if there is already in place any authentic version of the American religion, Western Mormonism, a very positive sentiment to the image that Mormons are shown as kind of a sanctimonious hypocrites and angels in America, you have this full range of attitudes towards Mormonism And what is interesting to me is that all of the attempts of the church, and it seems to me the success of the church in moving more into the mainstream, has not been successful in quelling this this very strong anti-Mormon sentiment in American culture. One of the ironies of the presidential campaign is that the criticism of Mitt Romney for things that he's been criticized for being inconsistent, unstable in his attitudes, dishonest, out of touch with the common person, all of these other things seem at variance with the very virtues that Mormonism has come to epitomize in American culture. Today's panel is going to discuss anti-Mormonism through the spectrum of the presidential campaign. And questions which I have suggested that the panelists consider, and also that I ask you as members of the audience to consider, are these. To what extent is today's resurgent anti-Mormonism a result of actions and positions taken by both the church and by Governor Romney? That is, had John Huntsman been the candidate instead of Mitt Romney, would we have anticipated this kind of the degree of anti-Mormonism? Is having a Mormon candidate for president a positive or a negative thing for the church and the Mormon community, both in the short run and in the long run? I have heard people say that certain general authorities were not happy that Romney was going to be running for president because they feared that all of the anti-Mormon sentiment that has come out would come out. Others very pleased that maybe getting it out is a healthy thing. What will be the nature of anti-Mormonism if Romney wins the election? And what will it be if he loses the election? If Romney loses, how will it affect the prospects of future Mormon candidates for president? How long will it be before another Mormon ventures into the presidential campaign if Romney loses? And were Romney running as a Democrat, who can imagine such a thing? An independent or a moderate Republican, would it make any difference in the nature of the anti-Mormonism that we've seen? So we'll proceed now with presentations from the panelists, and then we will have an addressing of these questions and others that those of you have come to participate in this interesting subject will do. We'll first hear from Patrick Mason. And from Jennifer Dobner, I will then say a few words and we will open it for an open discussion. Yes, question?
There's something about the cursor. It keeps looking
around. It's a little. Curse the cursor.
It's like
floating right
around.
It
kind of resurrects itself.
Don't we reject it?
I think it's gone now, isn't it?
I'll bet you if you close the laptop.
Then I won't be able to see what I've got to show you later.
It's a nice shade.
All right, well, thanks everybody for being here. And thanks to Bob for organizing this panel. He closed his opening remarks with a number of really terrific questions. I'm going to answer precisely zero of them today. When he invited me to be on this panel, I had sort of had one presentation in mind. But actually, as I've watched the campaign unfold, especially in recent weeks, and have reflected on that, a very different paper came out. So we'll see how this goes. There are several plague spots upon our national body politic, wrote prominent Nashville Baptist newspaper editor Edgar E. Polk in 1900. But one of the most terrible of the plague spots is what is known as Mormonism. Polk pulled no punches in launching his diatribe entitled The Mormon Monster, which was one of the most substantial works of anti-Mormon literature produced in the South during the period. Mormonism, he continued, is a travesty upon the name of religion, a stench in the nostrils of decency, a constantly running sore,
an immense octopus reaching out its slimy tentacles and seeking to seize hold upon our religious, social, and political institutions, an ugly and misshapen monster. I had to summon all my skill as a historian to figure out how he actually felt about Mormonism. years of graduate training paid off. In folks' estimation, Mormonism was not only a foul blot on the escutcheon of Christianity, it was also the octopus of our political life, and distinctly un-American. Mormon political might represented an existential threat to American democratic political institutions, and was even more ominous than Boss Tweed's Tammany Hall ring, since power was centralized not in corrupt Democratic Party bosses, but in a tyrannical priesthood hierarchy led by an authoritarian prophet that professed to be God's mouthpiece on the earth. The Mormon theocracy, according to Folk, exercised absolute political despotism over Utah, as well as bordering states Idaho, Wyoming, and Arizona, and sought to spread its dominion throughout the West, and ultimately the entire nation, resting at nothing until it placed its foul hand even upon the White House. After 300 pages, Folk concluded that the Republic was in mortal danger, and that all good, intelligent, law-abiding Christian citizens should resist the enemy at the gates. Edgar Folk was by no means alone in his analysis of the Mormon menace to the American Republic. A correspondent to a Methodist publication wrote that so utterly un-American is the Mormon theory that it or the Great Republic must sooner or later go to the wall. At the Fourth Baptist Congress in New York City in 1886, Reverend Richard Hartley declared that no man can be loyal to his country and loyal to Mormonism. Speaking from the same podium, Reverend T.A.K. Gessler noted that Mormons were a threat not only because of their theocratic structures and intent, as Edgar Folk had pointed out, but also because they had numbers to back it up. He warned, "The Mormons already are a voting power sufficiently strong to appeal to the patronage of a great political party. Here is the great danger of the future. Our political leaders care less for virtue than they do for votes. Questions of morality fall rapidly into the background when confronted by possibilities of political success or failure." Religious leaders like these were hardly the only ones expressing concern in the late 19th century. Every level of the federal government weighed in on the Mormon question. The Supreme Court ruled against Mormon polygamy in the Reynolds v. U.S. case in 1879. Congress passed anti-polygamy legislation in 1862, 1874, 1882, and 1887, all of which was accompanied with strident anti-Mormon sentiment. The issue also captivated the White House, as every president from Rutherford B. Hayes to Grover Cleveland made specific denunciations of Mormons and Mormonism, often in their annual addresses to Congress. Hayes, for instance, called for more strident measures against polygamy, including, if necessary, stripping its Mormon practitioners of the enjoyment and exercise of rights and privileges of citizenship. He even made anti-Mormonism a plank of his foreign policy. In August 1879, his administration sent a letter to the governments of Great Britain, Germany, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, requesting that they prevent Mormon converts from immigrating to the United States, on the grounds that all who come to this country for the purpose of affiliating with the Mormon Church do so with the avowed intention of becoming criminals. The European governments, by the way, politely declined the request, citing the difficulties of prosecuting people for supposed future criminal intent. They were probably just happy to get rid of the Mormons themselves. Finally, in his annual address in 1881, Chester Arthur noted that the expansion of Mormonism was well calculated to excite the liveliest interest and apprehension. It imposes upon Congress and the executive the duty of arraying against this barbarous system all the power which under the Constitution and the law they can wield for its destruction. So this is a snapshot, I would suggest, of 19th century political anti-Mormonism. Of course, politics isn't the only reason why the nation has paid attention to Mormonism, but it's one of the most prominent. The Latter-day Saints have long been in politics. Senator Reed Smoot was considered by many to be the most powerful man in Washington in the first third of the 20th century. The elevation of devout Mormons to the head of the Democratic Majority Senate, Harry Reid, and the Republican Party, now Mitt Romney, has helped bring a new spotlight to the religion. This has brought whiffs of the old accusations of an impending Mormon theocracy. But I want to suggest today that, in fact, precisely the opposite is occurring, or rather has already occurred. I admit that I haven't read every blog and article or watched every TV clip concerning Mormonism this political season. But from what I would have seen, I would argue today that anti-Mormonism, or for that matter, Mormonism, is not a relevant political category in national politics, and especially not in this year's presidential politics. This is not to say that Mormonism is irrelevant in politics. Certainly it matters, especially on the state level and local level in various places around the country. And I would affirm that Mormonism and its omnipresent anti-Mormon shadow remains a relevant cultural category. Indeed, there's no doubt that we're in the midst of a peak in national and even global interest in what Mormonism is, who Mormons are, and what it all means in the modern world. But I think that's different from political anti-Mormonism. As I see it right now, no serious person wants to play the anti-Mormon card as part of the political discussion. There have been multiple attempts to do so, people putting their toe in the water to test it, but I don't see it gaining traction. A few evangelicals, most famously Robert Jeffress, played the card in the primary, but ultimately it was a half-hearted attempt. Since it soon became apparent that there would be no viable evangelical candidate for them to support. Once Romney beat out his final two Catholic challengers, then evangelicals, including Pastor Jeffress, got into line. And since then, we've hardly heard a whisper of anti-Mormonism from that corner. This is not to say that they've all of a sudden warmed up to Mormonism or even to Romney. But since Jerry Falwell organized the moral majority in the late 1970s, politically inclined evangelicals have demonstrated a pragmatic willingness to check their theology at the door and support the person they see as the candidate who embraces their values, if not their faith. How else to explain their support for lukewarm Christian Ronald Reagan over authentically devout evangelical Jimmy Carter in 1980? Politics is the realm of Machiavelli, not Jesus, and so political evangelicals have learned that the enemy of their enemy is their friend. And it seems clear that Republican voting evangelicals hate Barack Obama more than they hate Mormons, and that's saying something. A few months ago, I was predicting that evangelicals would fall into line, but I've been a bit surprised that we haven't heard more political anti-Mormonism from the left, especially from secular liberals. But here, too, I think they're relative, and again, I'm talking about political anti-Mormonism, not cultural, not talking about funny underwear and things like that. Here, too, I think their relative silence is not because of any newfound affection for Mormons or Mormonism, but rather that they tested anti-Mormonism as a political category, and it didn't stick. We could think about the Lawrence O'Donnell clip, which is about as explicit as it gets, but there was immediate blowback to that. While that particular clip has gotten a lot of mileage, especially on the internet, it's mostly been people replaying it as an example of irresponsible journalism, not as an insightful bit of analysis that illuminates the campaign or the candidate. Last summer, David Axelrod, a consummate political strategist who's not above using anything or anyone to take down the opponent, made it clear that anyone in the Obama campaign portraying Romney as weird, which many saw as code language for Mormon, would be fired. Some of this code language was resurrected this spring, when Axelrod said that they would go after what he called Romney's penchant for secrecy. He thought this would play well with voters who would wonder, who is this guy? What does he stand for? What does he believe? What do we know about him? Now, the thing about code language is that it's code and can easily be dismissed as generic rather than specific. Still, I get a whiff of anti-Mormonism from this line of attack, since polls have regularly shown that the general public feels like they don't really understand who Mormons are and what they believe, and that they think that Mormons are secretive, which doesn't play well in a culture of transparency. But as the campaign is dragged into the summer, I don't hear this as a dominant theme in the Democratic Party's assault on Romney. Rather, it's been all about Romney the fat cat, the CEO, the job outsourcer, the tax dodger, the out-of-touch member and servant of the 1%. I think that the Obama campaign would resort to anti-Mormonism, explicit or implicit, if it would help them. I just think their calculation after floating a few trial balloons is that it won't help them, so they won't use it. And I've got to think that Obama himself is loath to go there, given the way his own religious commitments were dragged through the mud 4 years ago, and continue to be the inexplicable persistence with the inexplicable persistence of all the secret Muslim trash. In short, anti-Mormonism, I would suggest, is irrelevant as a political but not a cultural category in 2012. Now, a counter-argument could be mounted based on the Gallup poll from last month that reported that 18% of Americans wouldn't vote for a well-qualified presidential candidate in their political party who was Mormon, a figure that's essentially unchanged from the time of George Romney. 1 in 5 voters is not an insignificant number, but I have to admit being somewhat dubious about how important the number is, or at least what it really tells us. First of all, negativity toward a Mormon candidate is significantly affected by party affiliation. It increases from 10% among Republicans to 18% among independents to 24% among Democrats. I suspect that for many of those polled, a question in June 2012 about a generic Mormon candidate was really a referendum on Mitt Romney, at least in their own minds. Furthermore, the widespread assumption that a Mormon politician will probably be a conservative means that it's only natural that Democrats would be less likely to vote for one. They would say the same thing about evangelical Christians as well. No doubt there may be an actual anti-Mormon bias among at least some of these voters, but without further information, I'd argue that the 18% number actually represents primarily an anti-Romney sentiment on the one hand and an anti-religion sentiment on the other, both of which might play into a general antipathy toward a Mormon candidate, but neither of which necessarily reveals anti-Mormonism proper to be a salient political category. Ultimately, I think that in contrast to the context that Edgar Folk was writing in, anti-Mormonism is not a relevant political category precisely because Mormonism is not a relevant political category, at least not on the national level. The Mormonism that Edgar Folk and Rutherford B. Hayes railed against was a completely different animal than what exists in 2012. This is because the LDS Church, like every other major religious tradition in America, has become fully invested in a secularization model that has defined the modern West. By secularization, I don't necessarily mean secular in the sense of being the opposite of sacred. Rather, I'm using the term in its more technical sense, as defined by social scientists, to describe a relationship in which religion and politics are differentiated from one another, with each exercising authority in its own separate sphere. This doesn't mean that religion has disappeared, far from it, but the scope of its moral authority has been delimited to an ecclesiastical and spiritual rather than public and political realm. 19th century Mormonism largely challenged this differentiated worldview, and anti-Mormon writers like Folk were correct in pointing out that Mormon political theory and practice were in significant tension with mainstream American political theory and practice. It's a more complicated story than we have time to talk about here, but the basic fact is that the anti-Mormons won the argument, and secularization proceeded at a pace within Mormonism throughout the 20th century. So much so that when the LDS Church occasionally reverts to an older model and engages directly in politics or other civic affairs, see Prop 8 or the current MTC brouhaha, it does so rather uncomfortably and is openly questioned by many faithful members of the church who proclaim, "The church can't tell me how to vote." This is a crystalline expression of secularization as differentiation, if there ever was one. Unlike older, other world religions, Mormonism was born in a modern, secular age. Consider the opening language of the so-called Constitution of the Church of Christ, or Section 20 in today's Doctrine and Covenants. "The rise of the Church of Christ in these last days, being 1,830 years since the coming of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in the flesh, it being regularly organized and established, agreeable to the laws of our country, by the will and commandments of God." Judaism, Christianity, and Islam didn't have to file with the government to organize. So Mormonism was subject to the process of secularization from its very conception, applying the incarnation of Christ and his church to a modern age. Certainly there are competing elements of the faith that have more in common with the absolutizing elements of pre-modern religions, but in a sense we can say that secularization, including the differentiation of religion and politics, is in Mormonism's genetic code in a way that it never was with the older faiths. In conclusion, I suggest that there was a certain inevitability about Mormonism, situated as it is in modern America, accepting a differentiation of religion and politics. Joseph Smith's and Brigham Young's efforts at kingdom building notwithstanding. At the same time, there was a certain inevitability that once Mormonism conformed to the broad structures of American politics, it would gain a substantial measure of political acceptance in an expansively pluralistic public square. Nevertheless, as Martin Luther King reminded us, human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men and women willing to be co-workers with God. Thus, if Mitt Romney wins this election, we and he should recognize that he did so largely because political anti-Mormonism has been rendered irrelevant insofar as political Mormonism has learned to abide by American norms and America has learned to abide its minorities. If Romney does prevail in November, then when he stands on the inaugural podium in January 2013, he should open his address by thanking three co-workers with God. First, John F. Kennedy, for shattering the presidential stained glass ceiling for non-Protestants. Second, Wilford Woodruff, for dismantling Mormonism's political kingdom. And third, Harry Reid, for proving that Mormonism accepts political pluralism not only in theory but in fact. All of these developments, I would suggest, have helped render anti-Mormonism an irrelevant political category in 2012. Thanks.
Changed the plan because I wasn't sure if my battery was going to last, so I'm going to go before Jennifer. And hopefully whatever I did to close this has not been irreparably changed.
There you go.
I appreciate Patrick's thoughtful response to this question. I'm not so sure myself one can make such a clear distinction between cultural and political Mormonism or anti-Mormonism. It seems to me they bleed into one another rather easily. And one of the things that we face in looking at this is the extent to which a very large segment of the American populace, no matter what happens in terms of the presidential campaign, will see, and I can continue to see, Mormonism as a cult, see Mormons as other, and even though I think there are many positive signs, some of which Patrick has identified, that point to a greater accommodation and openness, I think that there still is something about Mormonism that still causes, the fact that there is 18%, however, one wants to explain or look at that, a fifth of the population says that they would not vote for a Mormon. It seems to me rather an astonishing figure. It may not ultimately be that astonishing when one looks at the kinds of things that Patrick has talked about. I wanted to show just a couple of clips that I think represent that darker side, which even though is true, does not make its way into mainstream media, still is nevertheless, it seems to be part of what the Latter-day Saints face, in the same way that I think President Obama is facing this still very persistent belief that he is Muslim, that he's non-Christian, that he was not born in the United States. I mean, I can't remember the statistics of the percentage of Republicans who believe that he is Muslim. Still, it's a shocking percentage. So it may be part of what one wants to examine is why do people persist in believing things that they choose to believe in spite of so much evidence to the contrary, which is another question. Okay, let's see what we have here.
Done.
why I'm not picking up the sound here. This was the program in which or the debate in which the question was, did Romney believe every word of the Bible literally? And he was, I think, seduced into a position that would be difficult to for a Mormon to justify. Sorry about this lack of coordination here with sound. In this particular thing, Romney felt, I think, pressured to take a position in relation to biblical literalism that he shared with the evangelicals. He believed every word in the Bible, and I think that that was an unfortunate time for him. I was going to see if I can... I don't know what the sound here. I may be...
Are you plugged into the sound system
somehow? Well, I thought I was. Oh, that's a good... Now, let's see, where's the sound system? That would probably help Bob to...
Probably would have had to, yeah. I don't know where the...
I'm not sure where the sound system is either, but I think there is one.
I don't see any wires.
Okay. Okay, well, we will go forward as if there were sound. Imagine, if you will, sound here. This was all working before I closed the lid. This is the one that shows the temple and the devil together, and this Mitt Romney's satanic belief. So you get some idea of Romney's belief being exposed as part of satanic worship. And you see this. And the sound, if you were hearing it, is very... very ominous sound coming across here right now. But you see these extreme figures of satanic worship and Mitt Romney. You get where the devil gives way and comes into Romney. So you have these obviously represent extreme examples, but nevertheless they are there on the internet, and one is able to see the degree to which those 19th century images and sentiments that Patrick talks about in his book, The Mormon Menace, Anti-Mormonism in the Postbellum South, are still out there. And I think part of my own experience, I taught American literature in the former Soviet Union during a time that my wife and I were humanitarian service volunteers for the church in the Baltic states. And what was really interesting to me was to look at the way in a culture in which there were no Mormons in the entire country of Lithuania when we went there, and to see what was represented as true about Mormons, both in the encyclopedias and in the general culture, in which you could find in the newspaper, you will see some young Americans knocking on your doors. Don't let them in. Their object is to come in and to rob you or to seduce your young women and to persuade them to move to Utah where they can become polygamous wives. And this wasn't very long ago, and of course it's in another country, but I think that we are, as human beings, inclined sometimes to believe the worst, especially if we already have some proclivity to see the people as other. Now, I think that if Romney becomes the president of the United States, then I think we will have to wait to see what the result of that will be. And I think one can see it as being going in either direction. Anyway, having failed in my great attempt to do audio visuals, I'll turn the time over to Jennifer.
Do you mind if I sit down?
Not at all. You may sit.
Does this work? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Okay. Sorry. I'm not an academic, so I'm feeling really dumb compared to what you said. And I don't have a bunch of prepared stuff, but I do want to talk a little bit about some of the conventions of journalism and conventions of public relations that contribute, I think, sometimes to what people might perceive as bias in the media. Feeling a little defensive for my profession at the moment, maybe. Because I've spent, 7.5 years as a beat writer covering the church, and so it was a really interesting experience in that. A couple things first. I think to some degree there's going to be bias in media in reporting. I don't come to anything as a blank slate. I come as a person, with my own faith tradition, my own ideas, and so I have limitations in terms of what I know about any subject, whether it's garbage rates at city council or Mormonism. And I think that in reporting, selectivity becomes inevitable. You can't cover every aspect of every single thing. There aren't enough hours in the day. There aren't enough, there's not enough room on the page. And so I think what you choose and who you choose to talk to about a given topic colors the eventual story that you produce for consumption. And I think that in there's some sort of mainstream media mindset that also is inevitable. We, as a profession, sometimes are like a herd of cats. We tend to follow each other around a little bit. If, reporter over here reports X, Y, and Z about the church, then an editor's going to say, can you match that? So we do a lot of matching and a lot of keeping up with the next guy that probably doesn't always lend itself to a lot of deep reading or, exploration of Mormon theology. And so what the public gets then is, about that deep, when in fact maybe the subject matter is about this deep. So I think that contributes to a perception that, if you don't go beyond the funny underwear and Kolob and the alleged Missouri zip code of the Garden of Eden, it's kind of hard to really get maybe what Mormonism is about. And I do think that particularly at this moment in history, there's somewhat of a trend towards more sensationalism in journalism, and the low-hanging fruit like Kolob and funny underwear is fodder for news stories. I mean, Mormonism is a very rich tradition with a lot of really interesting theology and doctrine, but some of it's a little odd to the rest of the world, and I think that it makes for interesting, storytelling. I do think that one of the things that's going on in media right now is that there's often a lack of understanding about religion as a whole. I mean, the American press may be the most secular group in American society. I've had vigorous arguments with many of my colleagues about whether or not you can be a person of faith and be a reporter. I think you can. Many people think that you can't. But it's also not our job, necessarily, to let that, color what we do. It's not my job to be the PR organ for this church or that church or any church. So I have to come to things with a more discerning eye. But I don't think you can, I don't think faith and news reporting have to be incongruent either. But I do think that there is, there are fewer probably, and Mark Silk might correct me here, but I think there's probably fewer actual reporters assigned to pure religion reporting at this time in history than maybe there have been ever. I mean, shrinking newsrooms have dismissed certain kinds of reporting as luxuries. Religion reporting would be, I mean, we're very lucky here in Salt Lake City. We have the very excellent work that Peggy Fletcher Stack does, but I don't know that there are very many Peggy Fletcher Stacks in the country anymore in American journalism. So there's a very good book out called, I have to put my glasses on, I've reached that stage in life. It's very depressing. called Blind Spot. It's when journalists don't get religion. And it suggests this, that because religion actually permeates about probably half of the news stories around the world in any given day. But the people who are actually covering those things don't often notice it because we're unchurched, largely, and we're unschooled in, you know, what's in the Bible or what's in the Book of Mormon or what's in the Quran. And so I think if you can't grasp the religious dimension of an event that you're covering, it becomes, you're only telling half the story. I think that's really evident when you read stories about Mormonism. Most of them don't get very deep. And there was an interesting thing that happened the other day. For those of you that are in Salt Lake, Mr. Romney, and I'm going to read it because you'll get it, I'm sure, because you're Mormons. Mr. Romney responded to the shootings at the movie theater in Colorado. You may have seen this, by saying, "We can offer comfort to someone near us who is suffering or heavy laden, and we can mourn with those who mourn in Colorado." So that's, does anybody know?
Mosiah,
okay. But I think there's only one reporter in the country who recognized it, and that's Tommy Burr, because he was raised in, like, I think, San Pete County, and he's a Mormon, and he covers politics in Washington. He's the only person who wrote about it, and he wrote about it on a blog. It doesn't really rise to the level of a news story, but it's kind of an interesting cultural factoid. But I don't think there's a lot of that goes on in reporting. Largely, I think what you have now are political reporters being asked to write stories about Mr. Romney's theology, and they may not get a lot of it. I think they miss a lot of it. I also think, and this is from my personal experience, that there are some conventions about the way the church responds to the press that also contribute to things that may be considered as biased. Here's an example. I mean, they rarely, and obviously they can't respond to every single request to have a general authority sit with me for an hour and a half, right? But they don't often present senior members of the church to for an interview. There was like not one the entire time during Proposition 8 until we got a phone call one morning and said, your slot is 11:15 and you're going to get 10 minutes. And I'm like, well, I have 27 questions. Do you think that we can get to those in 10 minutes? And you're going to be paired with another reporter. And actually, Peggy and I were paired together that day. And I said to her, I brought this many questions. How many did you bring? And she said, well, I brought this many. And I said, we're the last slot. I'm just going to keep talking until they throw us out. And that was the plan. But they have been very, what's the nice word for it? I mean, they're very,
shy.
Pardon me?
Shy. That's nice.
Shy.
Well, no, they work very hard to control the message. And they work very hard to control the access. And they work very hard to limit the opportunity for the wheels to come off the bus, right? But the wheels come off the bus sometimes. But I think that, you know, they once threw me under the bus publicly on a blog because they were unhappy with the story that I wrote about their image in the wake of Proposition 8. But they also did not provide anyone for an interview. And what they provided to me was, you know, like 2 30- or 40-word statements. And in that situation, I had kind of done something I don't normally do, which is I provided them with a couple of specific quotes of things that were being said about them, their anti-gay sort of image that was being created by this, because I felt like they were such strong statements that they needed to know what was going to be, you know, they needed to know what was being said so that they could appropriately respond. But when your response is 2 30-word statements and the story is, you know, 40 inches long, that's going to be an inadequate experience for whether you're the Mormon Church PR department or whether you're a Mormon in Ohio reading the newspaper. I mean, I think that sometimes, you know, the conventions of how any institution responds to what's going on in the media about them can create a situation in which they look like the deck is stacked against them. But the story doesn't say necessarily, well, I called them 27 times and this is all they gave me, right? So I think that contributes to the perception of bias. I also think that as media consumers, there's a Mormon narrative that filters the way Mormons sort of read and understand what's being written or said about them or produced about them in some video. I mean, if you come from the point of view that we are a persecuted people, much of what you read is going to feel inadequate, or it's going to seem wrong, or it's going to miss the point. So all of those pieces factor, to me, you know, as a journalist, factor into, you know, what gets presented and how it is perceived. So those don't really answer any of Bob's questions either. but you know, that's sort of my that's how I see the world. So that's what I offer. I do want to ask you guys a question, if that's okay, Bob.
Sure.
I was wondering what everyone's response was to the Business Week cover, and whether or not you perceived that as media bias. Because I'm on the fence about whether or not I think it's bias. I mean, I can see why it would be offensive, but I also see it as an artistic interpretation of whatever information that particular person had about some piece of Mormonism. So I'm just wondering.
Are you referring to Bloomberg?
Yes, I misspoke. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes. So I'm wondering what everybody thought about that.
Describe it.
It's a cartoon rendition of John the Baptist conferring the priesthood on Joseph Smith and
Oliver Cowdery.
Yeah, Oliver Cowdery. Anybody?
Yeah, I thought it was a little low.
If somebody wants to, you know, use the microphone there to respond.
I'm not Mormon, so I'm not very obedient, Bob. I'm sorry. Speaking of the wheels coming off the bus.
Okay, I had a friend who was thought it was quite offensive.
Mm-hmm.
I personally didn't. I thought it was satire, and it was making the point that it's inappropriate for religion, who's supposed to have spiritual ends, to be involved in, and claims to be directed by God, to be involved in building this mall in Salt Lake City and that sort of thing. So I thought it was kind of appropriate satirical comment on that activity that they were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But my friends who saw it, other Mormon friends who saw it, were pretty offended.
Journalism's not necessarily designed to be faith promoting, but so much of what Mormons are read is sort of channels them into sort of faith promoting ideas. So I think this is one of the conflicts that goes on.
Go ahead and use the microphone.
I saw the lady interviewed on TV that wrote the article,
mm-hmm.
and she explained what she went through trying to get information,
mm-hmm.
and how it was denied to her.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the magazine as soon as I found out about it because I was interested to see what she had to say. And a lot of what she says is true. It's correct. I know when I was a young man, the church published financial stuff. Now they keep it secret.
Mm-hmm.
They call it sacred, but it's secret. And then after she published this thing, and I have no way of ascertaining exactly the truthfulness of each of the elements of it, but the church comes out with their PR person and starts saying, well, you misrepresented, even though we wouldn't provide or answer your questions. And they do that every time.
Yeah, I'm lucky I have any hair left after 7 years. Because it is very frustrating from a reporting standpoint to be not necessarily stymied, but they don't answer certain kinds of questions. And when I interviewed Hinckley, they wanted the questions in advance, which, no. But, so, I'm sorry if I took over.
No, not at all. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Mark Silk. Jennifer alluded to me.
Sorry.
That's all right. I have been studying news coverage of religion for a long time, so I just would say a couple of things my name is Bo. There are a lot of studies have been over the years of of reporters and how religious they are, and they come out about the same general American populations. So I think it's important to bear that in mind. It's true, and I think it's a very important point that Jennifer makes, that the shrinking in the size of newsrooms, which generally is not appreciated, just how devastating newsrooms have been, in some cases by half to two-thirds of the number of reporters, has been a real problem, because those people with the expertise to cover religious subjects aren't there. And, covering religion is not like covering baseball. I mean, and I'm not saying that it's easy to cover baseball, but we learn baseball, and maybe football if you're a sports reporter, and maybe one other sport, and you're the lead reporter, and you know those sports. Mormons constitute 2% of the American population, and most of them don't live where most reporters are working. If you happen to be working in the Mormon Carter, and you are in Salt Lake in particular, then you get to know a lot about it. But, go to most religion departments and find a professor of American religion who knows a sufficient amount about Mormonism to write 800 words on deadline on the subject. It isn't easy. And as I think it's a real challenge to anyone. Also because, as Jen Schiff says, Mormons speak Mormon, and it sounds like English. But if you're trying to write about English,
right, so
you've got an inside vocabulary. And the final point, which really comes out to his latter remarks, I'll compare to having spent a little time with the lead reporters of the Vatican some years ago. I've never seen a more enraged bunch of people, because covering the Vatican is rather like covering general authorities. And so when you have a very hierarchical church, a religious institution, which is very much in the business of controlling its message, and Western religion is all about controlling its message. I mean, that's what's the gospel, but our good news, not your bad news. Then the challenges are very significant. I'm somewhat notorious in my local circle for being a defender of the press, but I do feel constrained to point out to people, you sit down on deadline over 2 days to put together a story about a complicated 200-year-old religious tradition.
Posthumous baptisms of Jews.
It is
super fun.
No case.
Well, and so I'll just anecdotally share, my first couple of years covering conference, right? Trump, as an Episcopalian by upbringing, going, what are they actually talking about? Because you have to really learn to read between the lines. And I was telling this story at lunch, I'm looking around on the Saturday afternoon section, and I'm the only person in the room not voting to sustain people. But I'm in the room full of reporters covering conference. And I'm like, why are they voting to sustain people? We're not participating. That's not our job.
It's a funny story about this. I require my students at Graduate Theological Union, where I teach Mormon studies, I require them to attend a three-hour block of Mormon worship service, and I require them to watch two sessions of conference and to write a report. And the discussion we had after one session of one class meeting after they watched conference, one of the persons said, I think they were too hasty in the voting, because I... I thought, sure, I saw some hands being raised in opposition, and they didn't really give them a chance. And I assured him, no, they weren't voting. He used to preface this by saying, every year we have a convention like that, and we talk about doctrine, and we all vote on the doctrine. And it was much too quick. One of the things that occurs to me that is we look at, the positive and negatives of this presidential campaign is kind of what it does. I was at the airport. The man who picked me up I took the shuttle up here said he was saying something about
we start talking about politics, and he said, you know, I'm just glad it's Romney instead of Huntsman, because he's not at all what we should be representing the church. I don't even think he's active, or whatever he was saying. But I think that one of the positive things is that it's put Mormonism into the national discourse in some ways that I think cannot all be bad. And let me give you just a quick two examples of that. I was invited back to the White House last month, part of the president's reception for gay, lesbian, and transgender, bisexual issues. Not because I am, but because I've been writing about this. Not because I'm all of those. And I went to dinner afterwards with a woman who has covered the White House for 20 years. And as we're sitting around talking about this, she said, you know, the most impressive in all the years that I've been covering religion for the White House and covering religion generally, she said, I must say that maybe one of the most impressive things that I saw was what your people did in New Orleans after the Hurricane Katrina. She said, it to me was so impressive to see this army of Latter-day Saints coming in without an agenda, without preaching. They just came in and they cleaned up and they worked and they did all of those things that you people do so well. She said, I was so impressed. That was one anecdote. Second is I approached the Marin Interfaith Council, where I live in Marin County, Northern California, about 6 months ago, and said, do you have any representatives from my church? She said, no, but we'd love to. And so I said, okay, I'll start coming to your meetings. She said, would you come and be one of the keynote speakers at our next breakfast? And would you be open to sitting on the council, being a member of the board? And then I got a call from Graduate Theological Union saying, we're putting together a forum on religion in the presidential campaign. Would you come and participate? So I think that in many ways, this is opening up opportunities for us to be part of the dialogue and discourse that would not happen without Mormons being part of the, without Mitt Romney being in this. So.
Yes, I just want to go back to, I just had a comment and then a question, going back to what Patrick has said, and then what you showed in some of your cartoons, that you were, you know, projecting those anti-Mormon things you were projecting. The comment is that when you were saying the people that Mitt Romney should thank for the fact that the political anti-Mormonism hasn't been a factor in this campaign, I would agree with you on those three people. And I, you know, John Kennedy, let's see, who are the other two?
Wilford Woodruff.
And Lester Bush.
And Harry Reid. I would agree that those three people helped to, you know, maybe normalize, you know, the situation for a Mormon candidate. But I would also add Romney in 2008. I think the fact that this was his second campaign, I think in the 2008 campaign, he performed the role that Al Smith performed for John Kennedy, you know, in 1928, and I think he performed that role for himself, and, you know, incidentally for John Huntsman, because when you had two Mormons running, I don't think it raised the eyebrows that it might have otherwise done. And I was going to go back to the question that I want to direct, I guess, to where all three of you is, you know, Patrick mentioned, well, you know, political Mormonism, anti-Mormonism, isn't that much of a factor in the election. And you don't see that so much in the mainstream media. You know, you mentioned Lawrence O'Donnell being slapped down for what he said. But yet cultural Mormonism, and I think that's kind of what you were showing, Robert, in the things that you were projecting on there. There seems to be this nasty cultural Mormonism that seems to be manifested not in the mainstream media, but, you know, on the internet, online, and all these blogs and everything else. And my question is this: how much of a factor do you see as this cultural or this kind of viral or internet type of anti-Mormonism influencing or informing voters, say, maybe I won't vote for a Mormon, maybe I'll be part of that 18%. I direct that to all three of you. Would you care to answer that?
Let me just say that the fourth person I would nominate for Romney to thank is Lester Bush. Because if Lester hadn't published his article on Mormonism Negro Doctrine in Dialogue in 1972 or whenever it was, and if that hadn't been influential in helping to change this, Romney wouldn't be a candidate today. The question about the really virulent stuff, in spite of the fact that Lawrence O'Donnell apologized, he has continued to be unremitting in his criticism of Romney. He has shown Mitt and Ann Romney in garments. He has he's spoken of Mitt Romney as a pedophile and all of these other things. And while the apology, to some extent, seemingly is half-hearted because he's continued to be extremely strong in his anti-Mormon sentiment. But I'll let other people address that.
Yeah, great comments, Newell. I mean, I could add another 50 people to the list of people that he should thank, starting, you know, with Roger Williams and others. So how far back do you want to go? Yeah. But absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with Bob that there is all this vicious anti-Mormon stuff that continues to be alive and well and has been given new energy by Romney's campaign. For me, and really the point I'm trying to make, and it's a very modest point, really, is that it's remarkable to me that kind of virulence, that kind of nasty anti-Mormon rhetoric hasn't elevated itself into the polite political discourse, insofar as it is polite, right? And that all, and again, it's not because I think that they wouldn't go there if they couldn't, but I think the calculation is that's maybe they can calculate on it existing on a sub rosa level, and that'll be enough, right? So who knows what kind of Machiavellian calculations are going on there? But it tells us something. I mean, really, this tells us something about America, right? In the way, and your Al Smith comment is apropos that anti-Catholicism was a real factor in 1928. And some people debate whether or not it was the factor in why he lost. It probably wasn't, but it was a very real factor. And it was a real factor in 1960, but Kennedy still won. He overcame it. And racism was a real factor for a lot of presidential candidates, including for Jesse Jackson. And it was a real factor for Barack Obama, but he overcame it. And there continues to be racism on the internet, and there continues to be subtle racism in political discourse and certainly in cultural discourse, let alone the Muslim stuff, which I think is largely racial, actually, more than religious. But he's overcome that, and it's not part of polite American political and cultural discourse. So that tells us something about America and the expansiveness of our pluralistic public square. But also that we protect the right to be nasty in private.
Well, we do have the right to be nasty in public too under the First Amendment.
Yeah.
But I do think most people are pretty careful when you tread on someone else's faith tradition.
Yeah.
And don't want to go there. Except for, you know, media is incredibly polarized right now, just like politics is incredibly polarized. And this is, you know, for I guess mainstream journalists, this is a big discomfort sometimes with the internet, what's out there that is irresponsible.
Yes, that's a good question.
Thank you. My thoughts will build upon what Dr. Mark Silk said just moments ago. As he talked about the leaning of the newsroom, there are fewer journalists, therefore religion topics are often assigned to journalists that doesn't have a religious core, religious background. And how awkward that could be. Specifically, I'm thinking, Robert, of one of your overheads had Mitt Romney on national media. And the question, which was printed across the bottom of the screen that he was asked to answer, was, quote, "Do you believe every word of the Bible literally?" And I'm thinking, talk about an unwinnable topic. I mean, to even attempt to address that topic is to chase down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
It's unwinnable. And to say yes or no has problems either way. And I'm wondering if the journalist who posed that question knew the problems and the journalist is knowingly attempting to lead the candidate down that path, or if the one who conceived that question honestly did not know its problems. So now to lead to my question. I think I'm leading this primarily to Jennifer, but any of the three of you can address it. How do you feel when the interviewee knows that you're not schooled on the topic that you're interviewing him about, and he steers the interview? He can answer the question that you may have asked him. He answers the question that you should have asked him or that he wishes you had asked him.
Well, that is the game. I mean, it's a bit of a game, those situations. But I mean, that's where you have to do your homework. You have to go in and have read. I mean, seriously, I spent 7 years reading about Mormons, and polygamists is my other favorite topic. Because I think the role of journalism is to advance the conversation and to be, you know, educators of the larger society. But it takes a lot of work, and to sort of your previous statement, I don't know if that journalist knew what a rabbit hole he was taking Romney down, but I think that it happens a lot, because there's time constraints, there's resource constraints, there's, you know, just all kinds of challenges to doing a really good deep interview. I can tell you that with the general authorities I've interviewed, I've been lucky to get 20 minutes. That's not a lot of time sometimes to ask a question. Really to get deep into a subject, and it's, you know, a lot of people criticize the media and they anybody could do that job, but it's a pretty hard job. I don't know if that really answers your question, but you have to try. And I can also tell you that you have to try to control. It's my interview, allegedly, except when it's Gordon B. Hinckley, and then it's his interview. I mean, it was his interview. He took it from me, like when I sat down, and he really controlled the conversation. But that is it's a big challenge. And you know, you can try to go back. I mean, the idea is if you have the question and they answer it this way, then you have to have the counterpoint piece of information. I interviewed Whitney Clayton about Proposition 8, and I was aware of some people in parts of the country who were being disciplined by their stake presidents and their bishops related to things they posted on the internet because they were supporting the group Mormons for Marriage during the Proposition 8 thing. And so I first asked about church discipline related to people who were not standing with the church on Proposition 8, and he told me that he didn't know anything about that. And I said, well, what about, you know, Jane and John Smith in Atlanta, who told me that you called their bishop and asked their bishop and their state? And he said, oh, I don't know anything about that. So, you know, you don't always get the answer to the question. And at some point, I can't spend 20 minutes just fighting with him over one answer. So you just move on to the next thing.
Thank you.
This is just an anecdote that I hope is relevant, but some months ago I was listening to a piece on NPR where a reporter was interviewing a professor of political science from a university in Georgia, a man who spoke with a very, very thick southern accent, and the reporter's question was, how will you feel if Mitt Romney does indeed become the Republican candidate for the President of the United States? And this professor answered, and he said, we won't like that. And he said, it will be very difficult for us to accept that. And the reporter went on to say, but then you will have a choice between voting for a Mormon and a black man. And there was just a pause, and he said, if it comes down to that, he said, I suppose that we will vote for the Mormon before we would ever vote for a black man. And I hope you will forgive me when I say that I have just been gleeful ever since thinking of the rather large percentage of the population now that is faced with that difficult problem.
I guess I'd like to see one of the questions that Robert posed there early on. Have you addressed it? And that one was, what if Mitt was a Democrat and a Republican? Or a really moderate Republican? And just a quick anecdote to kind of underlie that. I have a good friend who was very involved in politics, state senate. He even ran for governor in another state. He's a very evangelical Christian, very conservative. And I've talked with him about this, you know. He would say, I don't know what he'd say. I have a feeling that he won't even vote because he is so conflicted about this. Mm-hmm. I don't know statistics. I don't have a whole lot of anecdotal experience, but I come as a evangelical Christian myself. And I think I can understand something in the mind of a lot of us. I'm personally a Democrat when I vote, mostly, especially here in Utah. But I understand the conservative mind of a lot of people who are also very zealous about the anti-Mormon thing. And I suppose in parts of our country, there is a lot of people like this who are really conflicted at this point. What are we going to do? And I'm just wondering if a number of them are not even going to vote. Maybe they'll rise above that. And this will be the occasion to do that. I hope so. But I would just like to raise the question, what if that were a Democrat? And now, they're not only opposed to the Democrat, but they're opposed to a Mormon Democrat.
Yeah, what if he were a black Mormon Democrat?
As they are today?
I think it's a little easier for him because the opponent is Barack Obama. And that's unfortunate, right? That the law, I think Romney's going to win. He's going to sweep the South. We'll see about Florida and Virginia, but he'll basically sweep the South, not because they love him, but because they hate Democrats and they hate Barack Obama. And it's more substantive than that. It goes to a long history. It goes back decades. But that's going to make the vote. That's going to make holding the nose and voting for Romney a little easier. And I do think a lot of people will probably stay home. There are some polls that suggest that a lot of evangelicals will stay home. Whether there are enough that stay home that swing any particular state where there's a sizable evangelical community, I'm not sure. I mean, it was remarkable to me that as soon as it was clear, in March or so, that Romney had basically wrapped up the nomination, all of the elite evangelical leaders, the major ones who have been leading the political campaigns for the last 2 to 3 decades, they all fell in line and said, yeah, Romney's our guy.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think they have the power they used to. There's a younger generation of evangelicals who doesn't look at these guys as their leaders. And there's more and more evangelicals voting Democrat and so forth. So there's shifts within the evangelical population. In terms of what if Mitt Romney was Democrat, I mean, what if he was from Jupiter? I mean, I think Mitt Romney, we have a Harry Reid. There are Mormon Democrats. There's like 6 of them. And, but there are some. But I think they have to be even more closeted about their religion in the Democratic Party, then Romney has to be as the Republican nominee. I think the Democratic Party still has a religion problem.
Yeah.
And so that would be the problem there. I mean, that'll be interesting to me when we see it. You know, Barack Obama had to speak the language, and I think he is a religious person of a certain kind, but not of the kind of a George W. Bush or a Mitt Romney. So this is part of the divide we have in America right now that the parties represent on some level.
So there's kind of
anti-religion, not anti-Mormon.
That exactly right, and so that's where I think a lot of the secular liberals in the Democratic camp they you know for them it's not an anti-Mormon thing about Romney. I mean, Mormonism just stands in for all the things about religion they don't like. It doesn't really matter whether it's evangelical or a conservative Catholic or anything, because the nuances are sort of lost.
Well, we were talking about this earlier, that there is sort of a distinction, though, between a Harry Reid, who's elected by constituents in his own state to represent his own state, who may or may not, like if you're Orrin Hatch, it's a slam dunk, right? I mean, you're representing people who look like you, sound like you, think like you, talk like you, pray like you. It's a really different when it's the presidency. I mean, I think that is a different ballgame for people because that's the person who represents the collective we to the rest of the world. And people, I think, maybe have more discomfort with what kind of... We still want them to have a faith tradition, but we kind of want them to have it be something that we recognize or feel comfortable with. That's just my take on it. But
I think that for Mormons who feel that Romney's being treated unfairly... they really need to look. I mean, what you have, you know, I have a friend who's a patriarch in the church, and he said to me not too long ago, Barack Obama is the best president in my lifetime, which I thought was really an interesting thing coming from a Latter-day Saint patriarch. But the fact of the matter is that Obama is a very good Christian man. If he were white and shared the kind of values that he has, that he would be seen, I think, in a different way. So the anti-religion stuff works against Obama, I think, as much as it works against Romney.
So yeah. Can I just say one other thing? Because it was interesting this year during the caucuses here in Utah for state elected offices that the church came out so strongly saying, you know, remember, we should all be involved citizens participating in the process. And the Democrats had an unprecedented turnout.
Yes.
And the church line is always, we're politically neutral, but we think there are values in both parties that Mormons can embrace. And what I can say anecdotally from conversations that I've had that are sort of, you know, background or off the record kind of stuff is there is some discomfort with the idea that in order to be a good Mormon, you also have to be a Republican. Because not every person in the 12 is necessarily a Republican. They're not holding their hands up and saying which party they vote with. But I think that they recognize that there's some imbalance that they're not comfortable with.
I just want to quickly get a few things on the record. I think Axelrod was referring to Romney not releasing his taxes, by being secretive once he got to hide. I don't think it was a religious context, though. Boy, you really read line into that. I didn't take it at all. I think most of the attention in the public at large has been more anti-Obama when it comes to religion or anything else. Before I came here, I was on the Drudge Report lagging on. They said, could you vote for Obama or Romney because it was religion? And 13% said they'd never vote for Romney because it was religion. But 19% said Obama did because of that. They asked the 19% what religion is he. Two-thirds said he was Muslim. One-third said he was agnostic. So there's much more disinformation put out by the Donald Trumps, the Mark Levines. These people reach millions. You're talking about Bill Maher and Lawrence O'Donnell, which reads, what, 500,000 maybe a week, compared to what Limbaugh and Mark Levine and Glenn Beck and all these other people. Which Harry Reid, I was glad it was brought up. That was a very interesting election he had because the poll showed that two moderate Democrats would have cleaned the clock with him. But the Republicans nominated a Tea Party activist who wouldn't apologize for the statement that Detroit and Dallas were under Sharia law. When Rick Perry, of all people from Texas, said, shut up, or I can't endorse you, you're an idiot, she said, no, you don't know your own constitution. Dallas has seceded from Texas, and Dallas is under Sharia law. Look into it. So even with that statement, Mormon still supported her by about 52-48 margin. The only reason it wasn't a blowout is she still got the Mormon vote and the Tea Party vote. Every other vote, from Baptist to atheist to Jewish, went 2-3-1 for Reid. And this also brings up a thing. A lot of people don't like Reid at all. My niece and nephew-in-law are in a ward in Las Vegas. And when the bishop said that Reid was going to speak at a fireside, there were so many bomb threats, they had to cancel it. You know, his former state president wrote that when he helped Boxer and Feinstein try to block the federal anti-gay thing or whatever, they said, "You fear your party more than your God. Why are you still in the church?" And these people were so upset they leaked it, and that guy looked like an idiot. You know?
Well, because a friend of mine, you got somebody behind you can yield to. A friend of mine's son is Harry Reid's attorney. He said that they reported to me that Harry Reid sent that letter to somebody. I don't know, there's an address down here, 4070 South Temple or something like that. And that state president who wrote this this letter to Harry Reid was redressed rather summarily and severely for his comments. Thank you. Please, you.
We've been talking a lot about how Mormons are perceived, but I'm curious if any of you have a sense of how popular Romney is among the Mormons themselves.
And good question.
There's no question that Utah voted Romney. I understand that, but not all Mormons live in Utah, and not all Mormons who live in Utah are as impressed with Romney as everyone seems to think that the Mormons are. And on the particular issue of money and the haves and the have-nots, I'd like to know if you have any sense of how uncomfortable some Mormons may be with his sort of elite position, and that he may not look after the poor as well as they think that he should. And it seems to me that that's a rising concern among Mormons lately, and it seems not to match with Romney. I'm wondering if you have any comments on that.
Great question. Go ahead.
Yeah, great question. We have some good numbers. There's an excellent study by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life that came out a few months ago called Mormons in America or something like that. You can access it on their website, and it's the most extensive poll ever of Mormons about how they feel about lots of issues, including their place in American life. And they asked specifically about what's your support for the various candidates and things like that. In that poll, they showed more, and the poll is, there was a bit of a problem because it's self-identified Mormon, so it's basically church-going people. It's not taking into account the half or more of people on the list who don't self-identify anymore. But of the people who responded to the poll, Romney's favorability, or people who said they liked him and supported him, it was in the high 80s. Or low 90s, somewhere around 90%.
That's a percentage?
Yeah, percentage. Harry Reid was under 50%. John Huntsman a little higher than that. And there have also been other studies that look at majority Mormon counties and how they voted in primaries, and consistently in places like Montana and Idaho and Wyoming and places where you have majority. This was before the Utah primary. And consistently, Romney won at least 75% of the vote in all those majority Mormon counties. So he has, he has overwhelming support. So if these numbers are true and if they hold out, he will enjoy a greater success rate or get the vote of Mormons at a higher rate than Barack Obama does of African Americans, which is really something. We'll see if he can pull out 90% of the Mormon vote in November. But I know a lot of Mormon Democrats who are voting for him in November. They say because he's one of us. There's a strong sense of tribalism, a strong sense of this is our moment, we've arrived.
Could I have 10 seconds? I have a bumper sticker I got from a group in Seattle that says, "I am voting for Obama and I am a Mormon."
Jennifer, did you want to say something before we close?
I just would sort of like to ask the question, like, how many good Mormons would feel like they could even say they wouldn't vote for Romney? Like, I mean, there's a lot of, okay, all right, but there's a lot of social pressure in the tribe, you know, and in many ways, Mormons who have spent 180 years wanting everyone to like them.
100 years
wanting
everyone to
like them. Oh, well, yeah. Until the federal government tried to take your property, and then
when I gave a lecture at Graduate Theological Union in December, our Mormons Christian, this question came up. Someone said, "Well, you know, what is going to happen with regard to Romney?" And I said, "My own personal feeling is no one should vote against him because he's a Mormon, and nobody should vote for him because he's a Mormon. And that people should make that decision independent of that." Appreciate these panelists. Appreciate you coming very much. Let me just say in closing that something Patrick said that I'd like to reiterate. We live in a great country. I couldn't have imagined when I was a boy that there would be a black president. I couldn't have imagined even 20 years ago that we would have a Mormon candidate for president. I still can't imagine a gay general authority, but maybe I'll live long enough.